You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of July, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears. Aisha, what do you have for us today?
We've got China's slowing economic growth, Hong Kong's university problems, and Bruce Lee's new TV commercial 40 years on from his death.
Also on the show, defence budget cuts in Israel, but how will it affect foreign policy?
And we'll be heading to the south of France to enjoy one of the more eclectic music festivals on offers this summer, Giles Peterson's Worldwide.
The guys putting on the events there, I said to them, do you know somewhere we can do a little festival where we can sort of incorporate all the sort of bits and musical pieces that I sort of incorporate in my radio shows? And they're like, oh yeah, you've got to go to this little fishing town, sort of a bit different, it's called Set.
Plus, we'll be playing some music from our own playlist too. That is all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the latest world headlines.
Authorities in the northern Indian state of Uttarakhand now say that more than 5,500 people missing after devastating floods are presumed dead. 5,700 people remain unaccounted for since floods and landslides hit more than 4,000 villages. Until now, around 600 deaths had been confirmed. Justice officials in the United States say they're investigating whether a civil case can be brought over the death of a black teenager in Florida. It follows a jury's decision to clear neighborhood watchman George Zimmerman of the murder of Trayvon Martin. President Obama has called for calm reflection, but the verdict sparked protests in Florida and elsewhere.
This shows that our children really aren't safe. Anybody can do anything to them while they're out there minding their business. So it's a sad day, I think, for our justice system, and there needs to be some reform. And some people really need to think about the decision that was made today.
A senior U.S. official is to hold talks later in Cairo with Egypt's interim leaders. Deputy Secretary of State William Burns is to urge an end to the violence that's followed the army's move to depose the president, Mohamed Morsi. Egypt's public prosecutor has frozen the assets of 14 Islamist leaders, including the head of the Muslim Brotherhood and his deputy. Protesters on both sides are expected to stage further demonstrations today, coinciding with Mr. Burns' visit. Economic growth has slowed in China for a second successive quarter. The Chinese economy grew by 7.5% between April and June, down from 7.7% in the first 3 months of the year. The government has lowered its target for growth this year, but economist Rob Subraman warns the slowdown will have to be handled carefully.
The biggest danger we see for China is just because growth is starting to ease off, they suddenly relax all the monetary tightening measures, and we start to see debt building up again, the property market taking off again. And that is very dangerous, we think, because already the financial cycle is looking pretty excessive. And that can lead to a very severe recession if you have a crisis there.
There have been clashes in Bangladesh ahead of the verdict in the trial of an Islamist leader. Ghulam Assam is charged with war crimes, accused of orchestrating atrocities during Bangladesh's War of Independence more than 40 years ago. Mr. Assam is 91. Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty, but his supporters say the charges are politically motivated. 17 people have died after a stampede following a boxing match in Indonesia. 1,500 spectators tried to flee the stadium in the province of Papua through just two exits. 39 people were injured in the crush that followed. There's renewed pressure on Spain's prime minister to resign after further allegations in a secret payments scandal. It's claimed Mariano Rajoy sent text messages supporting his governing party's former treasurer, Luis Bárcenas. He is currently in custody, accused of corruption and tax fraud, charges he denies. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Well, thank you very much. It is 4 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You are listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, today we're joined by Aisha Spears, Monocle's bureau chief in Hong Kong. Aisha, thanks very much for joining us on the program. Where should we begin today?
I think we should begin with a story that you've picked up in your news anyway, which is the slowing of the Chinese economy, which is the growth is slowing to 7.5, has slowed to 7.5% in the second quarter, the second consecutive quarter of weakened growth, and it doesn't look like it's going to get particularly any better. So it seems that another worsening quarter could put the government target of 7.5% growth for 2013. The government won't reach it, and that would be the first time since the Asian financial crisis 15 years ago that the Chinese government wouldn't reach those kind of targets.
Okay, well, talk to us about the whys of this then. Presumably a bit of a slump in demand from overseas is part of this picture.
Indeed. So there have been faltering exports. They fell in June for the first time in more than a year. So a decrease in industrial exports is a huge problem for the Chinese economy. Retail has been a little bit sluggish and there's been softer investment, but it does seem there's a little bit of optimism in the domestic market, that instead of focusing particularly on getting more exports going, that the current government will focus on making sure that people domestically are spending money.
And tell us about the government's reaction then to these latest figures.
It doesn't seem that Beijing is particularly flustered. Premier Li hasn't said that they're going to put any massive stimulus plans into action yet. Some analysts reported in the South China Morning Post from Merrill Lynch have said that they expect that he will step in over the next few quarters, but not simply by stimulating manufacturing. Instead, he'll be spending, taking on more government spending that local governments are now having to do, so removing the burden from them, and also emphasizing infrastructure and cutting pollution as some sort of incentives for industrial growth. The new leadership is focused on more of a consumer-driven market, like I said, rather than export growth. So it could just be that we're seeing a shift in how China's economy is keeping itself afloat.
And looks to be something of a test of the resolve of Beijing and their actions at this point. I mean, looking ahead to the next quarter, what's the picture likely to look like then, do we think?
It does look like it's going to get worse and not better. Some people are saying that Beijing would accept a 7%, would go down as low as a 7% growth rate before they'd really start to panic. But retail sales are looking up, real estate investment is looking up. So it's just a question of watching what's going to happen over the next couple of quarters and seeing how Premier Li will respond.
Because Aisha, that really is the key point there, isn't it? That, you know, it can't be expected that China is going to continue to grow at this mammoth 7.5% growth rate every single year. They've got to slow down eventually, don't they?
Indeed, some critics are saying that looking at GDP in this way really isn't the way that China should measure their success. And if we're seeing a different kind of Chinese economy emerge, it might be a better one. You know, if they are focusing on issues like pollution and infrastructure, as opposed to just growth, it'll be a greater incentive, I assume, for other foreign companies to invest in the country.
Okay, Aisha, let's look at another story that you've picked out for us this morning. And this is a tightening of competition if you want to get to university in Hong Kong.
Indeed. So a recent report has shown there are two students now for every place at a Hong Kong university, of which there are four major universities here in Hong Kong. The way the education system works is if you meet a certain requirement in grades, you are technically qualified to earn a place at one of these universities. But the problem now is there are too many qualified people and too few places. In the last examinations measured by the Hong Kong Examinations and Assessment Authority, nearly 29,000 students obtained the score needed for university, but there are only 15,000 places. It's an increase in 7% of the pass rate from last year, so the government's going to have to work out what they can do.
Are there kind of plans to start opening perhaps more universities?
The problem is that it's only the second year that this kind of education system has been in place. They introduced the Hong Kong Diploma of Secondary Education, as I said, a couple of years ago, and it now means that the whole system has been restructured. Rather than taking A-levels, they're taking this new exam. Secondary school is now 6 years, university is now 4 years, and at the moment that's been the main issue for restructuring university places. So now a lot of students are forced to either pay full fees, some of them are opting for these sub-degree level things, so they're kind of two-year courses and then possibly going on to transfer into a full university degree, or for those that can afford it, they'll go abroad.
What do we know about why so many more people are meeting this minimum requirement? I mean, in the UK, there is the annual argument that's played out on the front pages of mid-market newspapers about whether or not grade inflation is a problem and whether or not qualifications are dumbing down. What are the arguments around more people hitting these requirements?
I think the issue is here more that the qualification has actually changed. And so now they're perhaps going to have to work out how to assess people more efficiently. Perhaps this new examination system isn't the best way of working out who should take these university places or not. I don't think it's as simple as things being dumbed down.
And have you noticed, Aisha, has there been a shift in what these students are perhaps studying and what they're being awarded?
Well, the new system tests them in the core subjects of mathematics, English, Chinese, and liberal studies. And it's liberal studies where students are apparently doing really well, and that's where a lot of people are getting higher grades than usual. The best performing core subject is liberal studies, and then there's also Chinese. So 51.4% of people scored a level 3 or higher, which is what's needed in Chinese. So perhaps they're going to have to change how these core subjects are assessed.
Okay, let's move on to the third story you've picked out for us this morning, Aisha. And Bruce Lee is back.
He is back. It's rather chilling. He's really back in quite clear form. Bruce Lee, who died 40 years ago here in Hong Kong, is now the star of a new Johnny Walker Blue Label ad, and it's really dividing his fans. The ad shows him on a rooftop in Causeway Bay amidst all the kind of very bright lights of the Hong Kong skyline. He's walking around. He's talking. He's speaking all of these kind of slogans that we associate with Bruce Lee about acting like being like water, and it's in fact a Bruce Lee lookalike who has then had a CGI imposed elite Bruce Lee face on top of him. A lot of people are quite astounded that Johnny Walker Blue Label would actually use Bruce Lee in this way.
Absolutely, Aisha. Dom and I were watching the commercial just before coming on air, and we were wondering, you know, who actually owns or manages the image of Bruce Lee?
Well, this ad was consulted on by Lee's daughter, so I assume that his family had something to do with this. The strangest thing is that Bruce Lee is known to have abstained from drinking after a bout of drinking apparently estranged him from his family, so that's an odd thing in itself. And an even stranger thing is that Bruce Lee, who is a Cantonese speaker in this ad, is speaking in Mandarin, and there is a Cantonese version, and it will be it's dubbed, which is rather strange. This is an ad that's aimed at the Chinese market, and they have now Bruce Lee, a famous Hong Konger, speaking in Mandarin, which is going to raise issues in itself.
Well, it's, I have to say, my opinion is it's kind of slightly sinister. That sort of mix, as you're saying, of they've used a sort of a body double, essentially, but then a sort of CGI'd bit of his face and then taken lines that he's said and put in all. It all seems a little bit kind of ghostly and strange to me. I'm going to quote some of the lines from here. Dragons never die because dragons draw power from water. Water, it's like instinct, shapeless, formless, fluid. You cannot grasp hold of it. Is that really going to sell whiskey? What do we think?
I don't know. I'm not sure that you really want to be talking about, you know, not dying to do with whiskey, to do with water, trying to sell whiskey. It is a very strange kind of branding exercise. It's the 40th anniversary of his death, so I guess some people at Johnny Walker are thinking this is going to honour his death, but a lot of people are very uncomfortable about it.
And Aisha, before we let you go, there's some news you might want to share. I hear some good news coming out of Hong Kong.
Are we talking about personal news?
I think so. Bizarrely, we are, apparently.
Bizarrely, yes, I'm recently engaged. So that is obviously the whole of Hong Kong is talking about it. It's across pages of the South China Morning Post.
I can't believe you buried that lead story as story number 4 of today's agenda setter. Hearts breaking across Hong Kong today. Aisha, thank you so much for joining us. And congratulations, of course. Aisha Spears is our bureau chief in Hong Kong.
Coming up, Israeli attacks on Syrian targets continue. We'll be in the Middle East for the latest.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
You can be European, meaning reliable, responsible, you believe in democracy and environmental protection and, you know, equal justice. These are all Islamic values too.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
It's not like New York, because New York, it's like you can walk to Central Park, you can walk anywhere you want. There's an urban continuity. In here, you have to get into a car or get into something that moves and get out of here.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Now, 10 days ago, on July 5th, there were a series of explosions near the Syrian port city of Latakia. The strikes are thought to have come from Israel, but the Israeli military has refused to confirm or deny. The target was Russian-made missiles, but human rights groups have said there were reports of deaths and injuries.
Now, it wouldn't be the first attack on Syria by Israel. Tel Aviv is believed to be engaged in a battle to prevent sophisticated weapons from falling into the hands of Syrian rebels. The confusion over what exactly did or didn't happen comes at a nervous time for the Israeli military, though. A series of budget cuts are incoming. So is the trajectory of the defence policy about to change in Israel? Well, Joseph Dana is our man in the region. He joins us on the line now from Tel Aviv. Joseph, welcome back to Midori House. Tell us, what do we know about exactly what happened here? It was a CNN report originally a couple of days ago that suggested that these strikes happened on July the 5th.
Well, we do know that there was these strikes on July the 5th, as we've just kind of explained, and the strikes have the fingerprints of the Israelis. They targeted advanced Russian-made missiles, which are basically anti-aircraft and anti-naval missiles, which the Israelis are clearly very worried about falling into the wrong hands. This is basically the fourth or fifth attack that has these kind of Israeli fingerprints, and if you look at the Israeli media, there's a pretty open debate here as to the extent of Israel's participation in this Syrian chaotic situation. And so most Israelis believe that, in fact, their army did attack this port city of Latakia, and this is a continuing effort by the Israelis to ensure that certain weapons don't fall into the wrong hands.
And those hands are the hands of Hezbollah. How worried are the Israelis getting over perhaps the Hezbollah gaining weapons from Syria?
Well, they're clearly very worried. The last open confrontation between Israel and Hezbollah was in 2006. And by most accounts, including accounts in Israel, Israel lost that war. Hezbollah has kind of emerged as a very, very strong and formidable foe for the Israeli army. And so the idea that advanced Russian-made anti-aircraft or anti-naval missiles were to fall into their hands is a very, very scary prospect for many Israelis.
Should we take anything from the timing, July the 5th? There was lots going on Egypt on July the 5th, wasn't there?
Absolutely. I was in Cairo reporting for Monocle, and so it was clear, you know, as someone that's following the Israeli situation very, very closely, I mean, this just kind of went under the radar because of the really dramatic events happening in Egypt. But it does demonstrate that the Israelis are kind of aware that they are involved in this Syrian crisis. They maintain that they're not involved, but any, you know, kind of neutral observer can see that their fingerprints are all over these attacks. And so they're trying to play, let's say, the media cycle to their advantage and take out these installations that they feel are threats to their national security when the time is right.
Joseph, how delicate then is the relationship at the moment between Russia and Israel?
Well, it's a very interesting relationship because there's about 1.5 million Russians that live in Israel. I mean, the Israelis and the Russians have a very strong visa waiver. For example, you can arrive in Moscow without a visa, and there's deep ties. But this is clearly a situation that is kind of bleeding into the diplomatic arena in which the Israelis are saying quite openly, I think, through these backdoor channels, that they cannot be supplying the Syrian regime right now because of the threat that these missiles will likely end up in the hands of Hezbollah or other regional foes. And so this is something that's definitely, I'm sure, clogging the back channels.
Okay, and this obviously is a connected element to this story. We were alluding there to the impending budget cuts. Give us an idea of what sort of scale the cuts coming to the IDF will be.
This is a very, very interesting piece of news considering the regional developments. These are the largest ever budget cuts in the history of the Israeli military, and they're calling for about $416 million to be cut by the end of this year and about $833 million to be cut at the end of next year. And so this is serious money we're talking about. And what will likely happen, or at least what the military is saying, is that between 3,000 and 5,000 5,000 career soldiers are going to be cut. Most of these people, ironically, will end up in the Israeli tech sector, which we talk often about, and there's a kind of pipeline between these two entities. But most significantly in these budget cuts is the fact that reserve duty is going to be cut. During that last war between Hezbollah and Israel in 2006, one of the major failings of the Israeli military was the preparedness of their reserve soldiers. And so it looks like these budget cuts are going to strike right at the heart of the area in which the Israeli military really needs to beef itself up based on the regional challenges happening or unfolding around everyone here.
And this news is something that obviously that the IDF aren't going to take lightly. The bit of back and forth between the Ministry of Finance and the IDF.
Absolutely. Any observer of the Israeli situation knows that Israel's army has an inflated budget, and it operates almost by itself. It's kind of like the Egyptian army in that way, ironically, that it's this semi-autonomous kind of creature in Israeli society that's able to call on resources as it wishes. And so the economic crisis in Israel, which has, you know, resulted in social justice protests, people on the streets in Tel Aviv protesting for better kind of economic planning, is really starting to pinch the Israeli military itself. And so it kind of demonstrates exactly the depth of the economic straits that Israel's in. And it's going to be interesting to see exactly how the military generals are going to, you know, kind of try and get their way, and whether or not they will appeal directly to the Israeli people, saying, you know, we are the army, we are the most kind of sacred institution here, and therefore we need a lot of money.
Joseph, thanks as ever for your insight this morning. Joseph Dana is our man in the region. Thanks as ever.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monaco 24.
Ot London, du er Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette er Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holland.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
From London.
To New York.
To Hong Kong.
To Shanghai.
To Jakarta.
To Moscow.
To Los Angeles.
To Beijing.
To Yokohama.
To Amsterdam.
To Cairo.
To Karachi.
To Bogota. All around the world, this is Monaco 24.
Phil, how do you like your whiskey? Straight up or on the rocks?
I'm a straight up kind of guy.
That surprises me, I have to say. I'm actually, thank you for asking, I am a more sort of whiskey and water, no ice, half and half. That's how I do it. But the Scottish whiskey industry is worth more than $6 billion. And that's only taking into consideration people who drink the stuff. But believe it or not, whiskey, or at least two byproducts of whiskey, are being developed into the next generation of biofuel.
By combining pot ale and draft, one company is hoping to produce biobutanol, a powerful alternative to fossil fuels. Well, Professor Martin Tagney is the man behind the project and founder of Celtic Renewables. He joins us on the line from our Hong Kong bureau. Many thanks for joining us, Martin. Let's just begin from the very beginning. Tell us how this stuff will actually work. How will you actually get biobutanol made from these two byproducts of whiskey?
It's pretty straightforward, because what I've done is I'm a microbiologist originally by training, and I worked on a fermentation that used to be the second biggest biological process in the world in its heyday. It's actually got a fascinating history. It was developed 100 years ago, actually. 1912 was the centenary year of the discovery of the organism. And these organisms will convert sugars and other carbohydrates into three valuable chemicals: acetone, butanol, and ethanol. And acetone was needed to make explosives during the First World War, and that's why the process was developed. So by the end of the Second World War, as I said, it was the second biggest biological industry the world had seen. Only the drinks industry itself was bigger than it. But it died out in the 60s because it couldn't compete with the petrochemical industry, and importantly, the cost of the substrates that were being used to make these chemicals got more and more and more expensive. So it died out, and then I simply looked to see when the chance came to redevelop the industry, focusing this time instead of explosives, but focusing on butanol as an advanced biofuel, I looked to see where was the biggest source of raw material that would be available in the country, which wouldn't cost us anything. And then that turned out to be, of course, the Scottish malt whisky industry.
Okay, and so you've got this far with this process now. What do you see as the potential for it?
Oh, the potential is enormous. When butanol was first recognised as a fuel, it was in 2005 when a chap by the name of David Ramey, very interesting man, drove his car 10,000 miles around America, totally unmodified engine, and just put raw butanol into the car. And then when you consider that it used to be the second biggest biological process in the world, well, we know how to make it biologically, and now we know it's a pretty good fuel. So everybody got involved in it. And like I said, you can run it in an unmodified engine neat, or you can blend it. In fact, most people don't know, but the courtesy cars in the Olympics last year ran on a blend of butanol and petrol. So the market is huge because it's sustainable, and we're mandated to do it. In Europe, it's 10% of all fuel must be biofuel by 2020, and in Asia, where I am at the moment, the Chinese government have brought in a mandate of 15% by 2020.
And as a startling figure here, more than 90% of the stuff that actually comes out of a whiskey distillery is not whiskey. Have you partnered with a whiskey maker in the UK?
We signed an agreement with Tullibardine Distillery. Our objective was to keep this as small and local as we can for as long as possible, so that it's small Scottish companies working together to build a bigger industry. But we do talk to the major players, Diageo and so forth, about bringing this to its full potential. The thing about whiskey you have to realise is that it's a highly specialised commodity product. Made from an age-old traditional process, only three ingredients are needed to make whiskey. You take barley and you do a malting process to release some sugar. You add yeast and water and you make a beer, and then you distill off the alcohol. And it's the alcohol that's matured in these traditional barrels that's the really high-value commodity, and the rest is worthless. But it contains carbon, and therefore it contains energy, and so it's only worthless if you can't do something useful with it, and we found a way of doing something very useful with it.
The sort of bioethanol, the whole subject seems to have developed another side, I suppose, in the last few years, with people talking about the amount of raw material that's necessary, sort of whole swathes of American farmland having their sort of purpose changed from one thing to another. Is there any concern from your end about the amount of raw material that this process will require?
No, in as much as if you don't think about it as being a biofuel industry, if you think in terms of we're a synergistic, compatible industry that's tapping into an existing generated product. So the whisky industry is going to grow. There are big markets in India and here in Asia where the Scottish malt whisky industry is expanding very dramatically. And you would hope for the UK, because it's the fourth biggest export in the whole of the UK is Scottish malt whisky, you would hope that for the economy that this will continue to grow. And every day that they produce a new bottle of whisky, they're producing much, much, much more of the byproducts. So we're simply taking a naturally occurring resource that allows the sustainable growth of one of the biggest industries in the country.
Are there any potential problems, though, with the use of butanol fuel?
No, like I said, BP are the company who've been trialling this for many years now. Since David Ramey first drove his car, everybody went, okay, well, how good can this fuel be? And it turns out that unlike ethanol you mentioned a while ago, ethanol is a 2-carbon alcohol and butanol is a 4-carbon alcohol. So butanol has more energy. It's like the old Duracell ad, if you put, you know, the batteries in the toys and one will run so far and the other will run much further. If you put ethanol, a litre of ethanol in a car and a litre of butanol in a car, the car with butanol will go 30% further. So in terms of getting it into the distribution system, you don't need to modify anything. You don't need to modify the infrastructure. It'll be brought in as a blend, because it will be. I'm not going to invent new petrol pumps and put them in UK forecourts and the forecourts around the world. It'll be the existing fuel companies that are going to distribute this as a blend. In fact, most fuel has a blend of biofuel in it anyway, because we're mandated in Europe by the EU to have it, and around the world there are mandates everywhere for it.
Martin, I note that you are in Hong Kong for a TED talk, and I notice on your Celtic Renewables website there are various sort of news items that have been done on this subject. Have you found that the idea of whiskey fuel has really generated a lot of excitement? Have people reacted to it?
And the reaction has been unprecedented, really. I suppose there's a little bit of the humorous element of an Irish guy messes around with Scottish whisky and starts making fuel from it.
Don't know what you mean.
I know, yeah. But But the reality is that, you know, it's simple. It's something that people can understand. I mean, the beauty of this has always been its simplicity. You want the whiskey industry to exist. You want it to grow. And we're adding value to products, byproducts of the industry that have no value. And it provides environmental sustainability. And it taps into carbon reduction, renewable energy. You know, it makes pretty good sense all around. And if you consider that, you know, whiskey was invented in Ireland, of course, as everybody knows, then... Oh, I love to tell that to the Scots. So Ireland has a big market, and if you look at places like India, Japan is one of the biggest producers in the world. And Japan's renewable energy portfolio was really nuclear and more nuclear, and that's kind of gone. So people have to look at what are their naturally occurring resources, and whiskey has residues that are a resource. And there'll be plenty of other things. One of the things, like you mentioned about ethanol earlier on, is that biofuel, I think, by its nature, kind of polarizes opinion. People understand little bits about it, but not a lot. It's perceived as being a single entity, which it isn't. There's lots of different types of biofuel. There's diesel fuel, there's ethanol, there's biobutanol that we're making, there's biogas. There's lots of different types. And each of those can be made in a very sustainable way, or perhaps in a not sustainable way. But yet people view it all as being one single thing. And I think that's why the message that people have perceived from what we're doing is that it's simple to understand, and it does look as if it's a fairly straightforward, sustainable thing for people to understand. But the biofuel sector is generally sustainable when it's done well, and people need to learn to understand and appreciate what it can achieve for the world, because let's face it, oil is not going to be with us forever, and we didn't come out of the Stone Age just because we ran out of rocks. You know, we need to start looking ahead.
Martin, thank you very much for explaining your business to us this morning. Professor Martin Tagney, thanks for joining us on the line from Hong Kong.
I wonder if maybe Bruce Lee will market the whiskey fuel.
Well, who knows?
Is Johnny Walker
what he might be like rolled out to advertise next?
Now, in the next half hour of the program, we'll be checking in with our correspondent in Sweden. We'll be leafing through this morning's Turkish front pages, and we'll also give you a taste of what's to come on today's edition of Culture, with a report from more international of music festivals taking place this summer. But before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the latest news.
In the last few minutes, an aging Islamist leader has been found guilty of war crimes charges linked to Bangladesh's War of Independence more than 40 years ago. Prosecutors have been demanding the death penalty for 91-year-old Ghulam Azam, who's accused of a role in more than 60 atrocities. Azam's supporters clashed with police ahead of the verdict. For a second successive quarter, economic growth has slowed in China. The world's second biggest economy grew by 7.5% between April and June, down from 7.7% at the start of the year. More than 5,500 people who've been missing since devastating floods in northern India have now been declared dead. Authorities in Uttarakhand say there is no prospect of finding any of them alive. Until now, around 600 deaths have been confirmed. Thousands of people across the United States have joined demonstrations after a man was acquitted over the killing of a black teenager in Florida. President Obama has called for a peaceful response to the not guilty verdict on George Zimmerman, who insisted he shot 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in self-defense. And more mass protests are expected today in Cairo as a senior U.S. official arrives for talks with Egypt's interim leaders. Deputy Secretary of State William Burns is expected to urge an end to the violence that followed the deposing of the president, Mohamed Morsi. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. Paul will be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world headlines. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Now it's that time of year where festival fever takes over the Northern Hemisphere, with a lineup that includes Syrian funk, Armenian piano jazz, New York hip-hop, and get ready for this, Afrobeat-inspired Parisian electro boogie-woogie. That's my favourite. I love that. There aren't many festivals that can claim to be as international as Giles Peterson's Worldwide. It's in its eighth year now, and the event continues to bring musical eclecticism to the otherwise sleepy town of Sète in southern France.
We sent Monocle producer Alid John to track down the man behind the festival and some of the groups bringing that worldwide sound to the Sètois.
Giles Peterson, DJ, music producer and festival curator, has spent his career espousing the delights of artists and oeuvres less heard of in the British and Western popular music scene. His work behind the turntables has for more than two decades brought Latin jazz, house and dance to the clubs on Europe's shores, while reminding the curious listener of the hidden genre-crossing gems of years gone by. His festival, Worldwide, brings these aims into sharp focus for a week of musical eclecticism by the sea in the south of France. I caught up with him at his studio in London to find out why he conceived the idea of the festival in the first place some 8 years ago.
The thing about the Worldwide for me was a little bit of a response, I think, to having spent 10 years curating music for the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland. After 10 years, they decided to knock it on the head, and I was a bit hurt by that because I'd brought so much sort of exclusive special events to that festival, which I felt had definitely lacked in edge for many years. It lived off its reputation for quite a while. I did a gig in Montpellier and it was so good. I remember telling the guys with whom I was doing the gig, because normally in France when you do gigs, you tend to, it was always good in Paris and Lyon, but regionally France was never that easy a place for DJs like myself. But suddenly in Montpellier, I suddenly found something really good, and the guys putting on the events there, I said to them, do you know somewhere we can do a little festival where we can sort of incorporate all the sort of bits and musical pieces that I sort of incorporate in my radio shows? And they're like, oh yeah, you gotta go to this little fishing town, sort of a bit different, it's called Set.
Set is a funny place, at once populated by fairly nonplussed, sun-kissed locals, enjoying what seems to be the definition of the good life, but also by the thousands of people who descend on the town to enjoy the delights of the many music festivals that take place over the summer months. Let's head down to the St. Christ venue, the lighthouse at the end of the town's pier, to find a Brazilian man whose music was first championed by Giles Peterson on this side of the pond, Marcus Valle.
Alô, som. Hey, more voice for me, please. Alô, som.
I started in 63. I have done a lot. I have started very early in Brazil. When I was 20, 21, I started to have my first songs recorded. Then I started to record by myself. Immediately after that, I have a song by the name of Summer Samba, So Nice, that became a hit in Brazil and a hit out of Brazil. Then I went to United States and stayed there. And then I started to go to Europe when Giles Peterson was one of the guys who started to play my music in the clubs in London. And then I got a new audience, a young audience.
The role of Giles Peterson as a man who introduces your music to another crowd, how important a role does he play for you?
Giles Peterson, it was very important because he was one of the first DJs that started to play my music in London. And so he did a very good job. Until today, I think Giles Peterson, he does a fantastic work, not only with the Brazilian music, but music from everywhere. So that's why I like very much to join his festival and anything that he needs.
That's Brazil done. Now on to France, the home of this festival and one of the more eclectic performers on the lineup, Xavier Thomas, aka De Bruyt. De Bruyt hails from Bretagne, moved to Glasgow, Paris, then London, and now resides in Brussels, from where he carves out his niche. Electro music, whose influences are so diverse, it defies easy definition.
The thing I do when I play, I play live, so I play with some machines, I don't have any turntables, and I only play my music, so my productions, I don't really DJ.
What draws you to African and Middle East influences?
The African stuff came when I was kind of experimenting with polyrhythmic sounds in electronic music, and I just realized that some people were actually doing it live with some acoustic music, and I was really impressed by all the groove and the complexity of the drums, but in a really natural way.
I guess a lot of people, like myself, would have been drawn to your music from the first song that I heard of yours, which was Nigeria What? Yeah.
I think it's the track that most people know me for. This track, obviously, Nigeria What, is a bit more, it's a bit faster, it's a bit clubby, so I think people heard it more everywhere, and it's distinctive, I think, the sound of it, and so people recognize it.
What is it about live playing that attracts you?
It's hard because a DJ has all the choice in the world between all the most amazing tracks that have been produced, like during the history of recorded music, and I only have my own tracks, so it should be impossible to compete with a great DJ, but I can do something on the music that DJ can't, because they only have a left right on two turntables most of the time, and I have access to all the little layers and beats and synths and little things in my own music, so I can do more little things and make it sound really lively, like it can change and surprise people like in a second, basically.
Back at the studio in London, Giles Peterson reflects on what has changed over the years since the first worldwide festival.
I just wanted us to treat the live musicians and the DJs in the same way, and for it to be as good for everybody, and for this complete diversity of sound to be able to make sense on a festival. Because I find as well, a lot of festivals, they just have it, it's eclectic, but it's not particularly got any rhythm, or there's no sense to it. And for me, you know, there has to be a sense. So that for me was really the essence of this festival, to incorporate jazz, soul, heritage music, electronic, the avant-garde, and a big dose of DJ culture. I wanted to do a festival which is going to give a lot of the DJs and musicians and artists that are part of the same kind of like-mindedness, you know, I think that it just allowed us all to be able to meet together, and it keeps us all encouraged and gives us all a big boost. We need that. I think that's what certain industries do better than others, and certain types of music have done better than others. I think that house music and the rave scene, they were very good at really sort of getting a little bit of energy and really marketing themselves. Yeah. I was always a little bit happy. I was always like, oh no, I'll just be in the back room playing my weird music. And actually, in the end, you go, actually, no, I think we need to celebrate what we do and the more alternative DJs. So that's the idea of this festival, and hopefully it gives everybody a nice boost.
So that was a journey around the musical globe, courtesy of Giles Peterson's Worldwide Festival and our man, Alid John.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a review of what's making the news in Sweden.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse.
I was at a bunga bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch, too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. And the guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them, and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, where the time is 9.43 in Stockholm. It's 8.43 here in London.
And it's time to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And yes, we are going to Stockholm to talk to Elna Andersson. Elna, how are you today?
I'm very well. How are you?
I think we're quite good, actually. We're looking forward to what's looking like a very sunny day yet again here in London.
It's a heat wave. We love it.
Yeah, Phil's in shorts, you'll be glad to know. But back to more important things. And three Swedish cities, I'm told, have joined a very elite list of innovative cities.
Yes, it's the OECD's list on innovative cities that's published in the Forbes magazine. On 15 innovative cities, and on the list of 15 cities, there's three from Sweden, which is quite well done.
So tell us, what cities are they, and what makes them so innovative?
The cities are the one that's highest up is Malmö. It's number four, and then there's Stockholm and Gothenburg. And, well, how the OECD measures this is by the number of patents and patent applications. And so it's they're obviously doing very, very well on that. And Malmö is also, there's a tradition of a close collaboration between universities and the businesses. So there's lots of collaborations like that going on and innovations being born.
And are we when we're talking about, we're measuring innovation by the number of patents registered. So are we talking about innovations in technology or design or which areas are these cities particularly excelling in? Do we know?
I think it's mostly technology where that this list is looking at.
Okay, and I'm told that number one was Eindhoven in the Netherlands. So well done, Eindhoven. Well, you're very innovative indeed.
And another topic that's getting lots of people talking there, it's women's football.
Yes, that's a big topic over here right now because the European Championships are being played in Sweden now, the Women's Football European Championships. And it's a sport that hasn't been a huge spectator sport before, but recently it's just gotten a big boost, and it's been showing it's shown live on TV, for instance, and a super big event.
Well, lots of women's football clubs in the rest of Europe will be wondering exactly how it is that Sweden's done what every sort of women's football game in European nations wants to do, which is become sort of full of household names, become a major draw. Hasn't quite happened, certainly in the UK. What have they done to boost the sport's popularity?
I think it's a lot about them being... The Swedes were pioneers in this area and started to really invest in girls' football and Swedish women's football. And now, recently, they've gotten successes, and they have this new coach, Pia Sundhage, who used to coach the U.S. women's football team. It's her first European Championships now, and so that's bringing more attention. And, they've got these talented players also. So I think it's a good package.
And, Alna, Sweden beat Finland the other day 5-0. Who are we expecting to come off as the champions?
Let's see. I mean, hopefully Sweden, of course, but you know, there's Italy, there's other countries that are strong, so it's hard to say.
Well, it's good to see you getting behind the Swedish team, Alna. That's excellent. And one last story. Stockholm is getting a new and very special museum.
Yes, it's the Nobel Museum. Of course, Alfred Nobel is probably the most well-known Swedish name or brand, and there has been a Nobel Museum before, but it's been small. And now there's a huge new architectural competition with 12 big name companies being invited to design the new museum. And we've got names like Rem Koolhaas and the Danish company Big, for instance, who will be joining to the competition. And in 2014, we should have some results.
Excellent stuff, Alna. Alna Andersson, Monocle's woman in Stockholm. Thanks very much, and good luck with the football.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. This is Monocle 24.
We'll have a roundup of the Turkish front pages in just a moment, but first a song to get us there, and a favourite of our next guest. This is Çürük by Mohla.
Limanından
Mullah there with Chudik.
And now it is time for us to leave through this morning's Turkish front pages with Monocle's own Alexander de Kramer. Alex, welcome to the show. Was that a favorite song of yours, I hear?
You're a big fan of Chudik, course. Right? No. 70s.
You like
my
the
favorite
old stuff.
70s song.
Like the old stuff. Where should we begin today? Shall we start with the Hurriyet?
So I came up with so the columnist and former editor in chief of Hurriyet wrote this really interesting article about a report about fasting in Ramadan in Turkey, which apparently last year there was 40%. Usually it ranges between 42 and 40% of people fast during the month of Ramadan. And this year it's only 32%, which I'm assuming is kind of like a protest movement against the government as well. Plus, we also have to think that it's this year it's 17 hours of fasting. So maybe that's also one of the reasons people are not fasting 30 minutes more than last year. And
Where do these figures come from?
It's the catering companies for big businesses. So that's where he got it from.
And where, like, you know, obviously Turkey is a Muslim country, but where kind of are the hot spots where people are practicing Ramadan and fasting for those 17 hours?
So, Istanbul is actually the highest ranked where people fast most, and you'd think that like Anatolia and eastern of Turkey would be the highest ranking for people that are fasting the most, but actually it's the west, it's the Marmara region, Bursa, Elazığ, and Istanbul. Izmir, obviously, is one of the last. It's like 15% of the people are
and
fasting.
I suppose, given what we have seen in the last couple of months, centering and starting in Istanbul, yeah, it is something of a surprise that might be the centre of sort of observant Muslims during Ramadan.
True. Yeah. It's also... Ramadan also costs a lot of money. That's also one of the things. It's apparently $2 billion for Turkey just to put out. They feed around 1 million people every day minimum, which is an interesting statistics if you think about how much the government spends during the Ramadan month.
Well, let's move on to the Cumhuriyet newspaper. They have a story there about Prime Minister Erdogan. He's not helping the case, really. He's not going to win any friends with these protesters with comments like, stop banging on pots and pans.
Yeah, so that was an interesting demonstration. So after 9 p.m. in Istanbul, Izmir and Ankara, people start banging pots and pans and switching lights on and off, which is still ongoing. And he actually talked with the Interior Minister and he gave a speech on TV saying, we're going to start issuing warrants about these, and people are affecting the public. It's affecting the public in a wrong manner, and people should stop banging pots and pans. Basically,
I mean, talk to us about the significance of the banging of the pot and the pan. Presumably, it's everyone's doing it because it's something you can do easily. It makes a lot of noise. You can do it outside your window, and you can see that your neighbor's doing it as well, and like,
and gives it a nice sense of unity that everyone, yeah, and it's actually, yeah.
Thank you very much, Phil. Calling
and
time.
It's really weird because it's an ongoing thing in Turkish history. It was there in the 80s. It was there during the military coup. That's what people did, because you can't arrest, you don't know where the music, where the sound is coming from, so you can't just barge into people's houses and arrest them. So that's a nice way of concealing, like still demonstrating but concealing your identity,
because it does seem quite unthinkable. How on earth are they going to be able to police this? You know, they said they're going to issue warrants out to people that are doing this after 9 p.m. but are they going to have police kind of trawling the streets of Istanbul and listening for pots and pans? And
Yeah, it's just to spread fear, just like to tell people like, I'm in charge, stop doing it. It's a reoccurring attitude of Erdogan that's somehow not disappearing, which is really interesting.
Well, I mean, how would you police it? Like, you get a knock on the door and it's like, no, I just dropped some pans. Yeah. It wasn't a protest.
I was making pasta
and it all fell down. I'm really sorry. Yeah. I won't do it again. I mean, well, talk to us. You know, you clearly have friends and colleagues and contacts in Istanbul and thereabouts. What do they tell you about how things have changed in the last few weeks? You know, it feels like, internationally at least, it sort of stepped back from this really very tense situation. What do they tell you about what it's like now?
True. I I was told that a lot of people still are going to Gezi Park and protesting, but 100% has diminished because of what's happening in the world and Egypt, because we're really involved with Egypt as well. So I don't know. And people haven't really, we haven't really, they obviously their voices have been heard, but they haven't got what they wanted. And they're still doing really peaceful protests. Like there was this, Cumhuriyet had this really interesting picture you can see. So in Bodrum, people held hands and protested because this is a new movement, like the standing protest.
This is so across the top of the newspaper, we have this long shot of people across a stretch of water holding hands, and it must go on for, 200 metres or something. It's quite something.
It looks like a scene from Mamma Mia or something.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what they're aiming for. What's the third story you've got for us today, Alex?
So the Association of Photographers published a report, obviously something we knew, that 111 photographers were detained and violently beaten during Gezi Park, which is another interesting aspect, although we know that the media is really suppressed. It's another, at least these reports are coming out.
And in a lot of countries, people that work as journalists, they're given press cards, essentially, what allows them to go into certain parts or you know, they can get through police lines. So many of the report also found that many of these journalists who actually carried those yellow press cards, they were essentially ignored.
Exactly. Which is comes to the point that the Turkish police really, because the government still claims that the police weren't violent, and of course they were thinking about human rights, and they were being helpful to people, and they didn't beat anyone. But obviously this report says otherwise, and I don't know how many more reports they need to prove that the police were violent. There was this interesting thing that happened on Friday in the parliament. There's a BDP member who's a socialist called Cyrus Reya Önder, and he was the first people to be protesting in Gezi Park, and he got hit by a tear gas canister, which he was hospitalized for. So he's giving this speech in the parliament, and an AKP member says, "The police weren't violent. I don't believe this man is lying." And so he starts undressing. He's like, "You call me a liar," and he like undresses to show his like
to show the sort of bruise where the canister hit him.
He's kind of become like a hero for the people.
And it was in the papers over the weekend as well.
Yeah,
and it was quite a startling photo because you see this man with this huge bruise on the side of his stomach. So indeed, it was startling. Alex de Kramer there. Many thanks for joining us with a wrap of the Turkish front pages.
And that is all we have time for today's Midori House. Thanks to our producer, Alid John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Tess McCann too, and the studio manager, who today was Alex Funnell. Next up after the news, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck.
And both Dominic and I will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.